The following article was written by Imran Khan in January 2010. Imran has since gone on to be a quite successful Pakistani politician. And the article in question is called The Misandry Bubble. The Misandry Bubble by Imran Khan. Why does it seem that American society is in decline, that fairness and decorum are receding, that mediocrity and tyranny are becoming malignant despite the majority of the public being averse to such philosophies, yet the true cause seems elusive? What if everything from unsustainable health care and social security costs to stagnant wages and rising crime to crumbling infrastructure and metastasizing socialism, to the economic decline of major U.S. cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore, could all be traced to a common origin that is extremely pervasive, yet is all but absent from the national dialogue, indeed, from the dialogue of the entire Western world. Today, on the first day of the new decade of the 2010 years, I am going to tell you what that is. I am hereby triggering the national dialogue on what the foremost challenge for the United States will be in this decade, which is the ultimate root cause of most of the other problems we appear to be struggling with. What you are about to read is the equivalent of someone in 1997 describing the expected forces governing the war on terror from 2001 to 2009 in profound detail. This is a very long article, the longest ever written on the Futurist, as it is a guide to the next decade of social, political, and sexual strife. It is not meant to be read in one shot, but rather digested slowly over an extended period, with all supporting links read as well. As the months and years of this decade progress, this article will seem all the more prophetic. The abstract. The Western world has quietly become a civilization that has funny tainted the interaction between men and women, where the state forcibly transfers resources from men to women, creating various perverse incentives for otherwise good women to inflict great harm onto their own families, and where male nature is vilified, but female nature is celebrated. This is unfair to both genders, and is a recipe for rapid civilizational decline and displacement, the costs of which will soon be borne by a subsequent generation of innocent women rather than men as soon as 2020. Now, the basic premise of this article is that men and women are equally valuable, but have different strengths and weaknesses and different priorities. A society is strongest when men and women have roles that are complementary to each other rather than of an adversarial nature. Furthermore, when one gender, either one, is mistreated, the other ends up becoming disenfranchised as well. If you disagree with this premise, you may not wish to read any further. The myth of female oppression. When you tell someone that they are oppressed, against all statistical and logical evidence, you harm them by generating discouragement and resentment. This pernicious effect is the basis of many forms of needlessly inflicted female unhappiness, as well as the basis for unjustified retaliation against men. All of us have been taught how women have supposedly been oppressed throughout human existence, and that this was pervasive, systemic, and endorsed by ordinary men who did not face hardships as severe as what women endured. In reality, this narrative is entirely incorrect. The average man was forced to risk death on the battlefield, at sea, or in mines, while most women stayed indoors tending to children and household duties first. Male life expectancy was always significantly lower than that of females, and still is. Warfare has been a near constant feature of human society before the modern era, and whenever two tribes or kingdoms went to war with each other, the losing side saw many of its fighting age men exterminated, while the women were assimilated into the invading society. Now, becoming a concubine or a housekeeper is an unfortunate fate, but not nearly as bad as being slaughtered in battle as the men were. To anyone who disagrees, would you like for the men and women to trade outcomes? Most of this narrative stems from feminists comparing the plight of average women to the topmost men, the monarch and the other aristocrats, rather than to the average man. This practice is known as an apex fallacy, and whether accidental or deliberate, entirely misrepresents reality. To approximate the conditions of the average woman to the average man, the key word being average, in the Western world of a century ago, simply observe the lives of the poorest peasants in poor countries today. Both men and women have to perform tedious work, have insufficient food and clothing, and limited opportunities for upliftment. As far as selective anecdotes like voting rights go, in the vast majority of cases, men could not vote either. In fact, if one compares every nation-state from every century, virtually all of them extended exactly the same voting rights, or lack thereof, to men and women. Even today, out of 200 sovereign states, there are exactly zero that have a different class of voting rights to men and women. Any claims that women were being denied rights that men were given in even 1% of historical instances falls flat. That is not to deny that genuine atrocities like genital mutilation have been perpetrated against the women. They have and still are. But men also experience atrocities of comparable horror at the same time, which is simply not mentioned. In fact, when a man is genitally mutilated by a woman, some other women find this humorous and are proud to say so publicly. It is already wrong when a contemporary group seeks reparations from an injustice that occurred over a century ago to people who are no longer alive. It is even worse when this oppression itself is a fabrication. The narrative of female oppression by men should be rejected and refuted as the highly selective and historically false narrative that it is. In fact, this myth is evidence not of historical oppression, but of the vastly different propensity to complain between the two genders. The masculinity vacuum in entertainment. Take a look at the collage of entertainers, which will be relevant if you are older than 30. All of them were prominent in the 80s, some spilling over on either side of that decade. They are all certainly very different from one another, but they all have one thing in common, that there are far fewer comparable personas produced by Hollywood today. As diverse and imperfect as these characters were, they were all examples of masculinity. They represented different archetypes, from the father, to the leader, to the ladies' man, to the rugged outdoorsman, to the protector. They were all more similar than dissimilar, as they all were role models for young boys of the time, often the same young boys. Celebrities as disparate as Bill Cosby and Mr. T had majority overlap in their fan bases, as did characters as contrasting as Jean-Luc Picard and the macho man Randy Savage. At this point, you might be feeling a deep inner emptiness lamenting a bygone age, as the paucity of proudly inspiring masculine characters in modern entertainment becomes clear. Before the 1980s, there were different masculine characters, but today, they are conspicuously absent. Men are shown either as thuggish degenerates or as effete androgynes. Sure, there were remakes of Star Trek and the A-Team, and series finales of Rocky and Indiana Jones, but where are the new characters? Why is the vacuum being filled solely with nostalgia? A single example, like Jack Bauer, is not sufficient to dispute the much larger trend of masculinity purging. Modern entertainment typically shows businessmen as villains and husbands as bumbling dimwits that are always under the command of the all-powerful wife, who is never wrong. Oprah Winfrey's platform always grants a sympathetic portrayal to a wronged woman, but never to men who have suffered great injustices. Absurdly false feminist myths, such as a belief that women are underpaid relative to men for the same output of work, or that adultery and domestic violence are actions committed exclusively by men, are embedded even within the dialogue of sitcoms and legal dramas. This trains women to disrespect men, wives to think poorly of their husbands, and girls to devalue the importance of their fathers, which leads to the normalization of single motherhood, obviously with taxpayer subsidies, despite the reality that most single mothers are not victims, but merely women who rode a carousel of men with reckless abandon. This, in turn, leads to fatherless young men growing up being told that natural male behavior is wrong and feminization is normal. It also leads to women being deceived outright about the realities of the sexual market, where media attempts to normalize single motherhood and attempted cougarhood are glorified rather than portrayed as the undesirable conditions that they are. The primal nature of men and women. Genetic research has shown that before the modern era, 80% of women managed to reproduce, but only 40% of men did. The obvious conclusion from this is that a few top men had multiple wives, while the bottom 60% had no mating prospects at all. Women clearly did not mind sharing the top man with multiple other women, ultimately deciding that being one of four women sharing an alpha was still more preferable than having the undivided attention of a beta. Let us define the top 20% of men, as measured by their attractiveness to women, as alpha males, while the middle 60% of men will be called beta males. The bottom 20% are not meaningful in this context. Research across gorillas, chimpanzees, and primitive human tribes show that men are promiscuous and polygamous. This is no surprise to a modern reader, but the research further shows that women are not monogamous, as it is popularly assumed, but hypergamous. In other words, a woman may be attracted to only one man at any given time, but as the status and fortune of various men fluctuates, a woman's attention may shift from a declining man to an ascendant man. There is significant turnover in the ranks of alpha males, which women are acutely aware of. As a result, women are the first to want into a monogamous relationship and the first to want out. This is neither right nor wrong, merely natural. What is wrong, however, is the cultural and societal pressure to shame men into committing to marriage under the pretense that they are afraid of commitment due to some Peter Pan complex, while there is no longer the corresponding traditional shame that was reserved for women who destroyed the marriage, despite the fact that 90% of divorces are initiated by women. Furthermore, when women destroy the commitment, there is great harm to children, and the woman demands present and future payments from the man she is abandoning. A man who refuses to marry is neither harming innocent minors nor expecting years of payments from a woman. This absurd double standards has invisible but major costs to society. To provide beta men an incentive to produce far more economic output than needed just to support themselves, while simultaneously controlling the hypergamy of women that would deprive children of interaction with their biological fathers, all major religions constructed an institution to force constructive conduct out of both genders while penalizing the natural primate tendencies of each. This institution was known as marriage. Societies that enforced monogamous marriage made sure all beta men had wives, thus unlocking productive output out of these men who in pre-modern times would have had no incentive to be productive. Women, in turn, received a provider, a protector, and higher social status than unmarried women, who often were trapped in poverty. When applied over an entire population of humans, this system was known as civilization. All societies that achieved great advances and lasted for multiple centuries followed this formula with very little deviation, and it is quite remarkable how similar the nature of monogamous marriage was across seemingly diverse cultures. Societies that deviated from this were quickly replaced. This contract between the sexes was advantageous to beta men, women over the age of 35, and children, but greatly curbed the activities of alpha men and women under 35, together a much smaller group than the former one. Conversely, the pre-civilized norm of alpha men monopolizing three or more young women each, replacing aging ones with new ones, whereas the masses of beta men fight over a tiny supply of surplus of aging women, was chaotic and unstable, leaving beta men violent and unproductive, and aging mothers discarded by their alpha mates now vulnerable to poverty. So what happens when the traditional controls of civilization are lifted from both men and women? The Four Sirens. Four unrelated forces simultaneously combined to entirely distort the balance of civilization built on the biological realities of men and women. Others have presented versions of the Four Sirens concept in the past, but I am choosing a slightly different definition of the Four Sirens. The first siren, easy contraception, condoms, pills, and abortions. In the past, extremely few women ever had more than one or two sexual partners in their lives, as being an unwed mother led to poverty and social ostracization. Contraception made it possible for females to act on their urges of hypergamy. 2. No-fault divorce, asset division, and alimony. In the past, a woman who wanted to leave her husband needed to prove misconduct on his part. Now, the law has changed to such a degree that a woman can leave her husband for no stated reason, yet is still entitled to payments from him for years to come. This incentivizes destruction because it enables women to transfer the costs of irresponsible behavior onto men and children. 3. Female economic freedom. Despite feminists claiming that this is the fruit of their hard work, inventions like the vacuum cleaner, washing machine, and oven were the primary drivers behind liberating women from household chores and freeing them up to enter the workforce. These inventions compressed the chores that took a full day into just an hour or less. There was never any organized male opposition to women entering the workforce. In China, taxes were collected in a way that mandated female productivity, as more labor lowered costs while also creating new customers. However, one of the main reasons that women married, financial support, was no longer a necessity. Female entry into the workforce is generally a positive development for society, and I would be the first to praise this if it were solely on the basis of merit, as old-school feminists had genuinely intended. Unfortunately, too much of this is now due to corrupt political lobbying to forcibly transfer resources from men to women. The fourth of the sirens is female-centric social engineering. Above and beyond the pro-woman divorce laws, further state interventions include the subsidization of single motherhood, laws that criminalize violence against women but offer no protection to men who are the victims of violence by women, which happens just as often, and sexual harassment laws with definitions so nebulous that women have the power to accuse men of anything without the man having any rights of his own. These four forces in tandem handed an unprecedented level of power to women. The technology gave them freedom to pursue careers and the freedom to be promiscuous. Feminist laws have done a remarkable job of shielding women from the consequences of their actions. Women now have as close to a hypergamous utopia as has ever existed, where they can pursue alpha males while extracting subsidization from beta males without any reciprocal obligations to them. Despite all the new freedoms available to women that freed them from their traditional responsibilities, men were still expected to adhere to their traditional responsibilities. Marriage 2.0. From the West to the Middle East to Asia, marriage is considered a mandatory bedrock of any functioning society. If marriage is such a crucial ingredient of societal health, then the West is barreling ahead on a suicidal path. We earlier discussed why marriage was created, but equally important were the factors that sustained the institution and kept it true to its objectives. The reason that marriages worked not too long ago were: 1. People married at the age of 20 and often died by the age of 50. People were virgins at marriage, and women spent their 20s tending to three or more children. The wife retained her beauty 15 years into the marriage, and the lack of processed junk food kept her slim even after that. This is an entirely different psychological foundation than the present urban norm of a woman marrying at the age of 34 after having had 10 or more prior sexual relationships, who then promptly emerges from her svelte chrysalis in an event that can best be described as a fat apocalypse. 2. It was entirely normal for 10 to 20% of young men to die or be crippled on the battlefield or in occupational accidents. Hence, there were always significantly more women than able-bodied men in the 20 to 40 age group, ensuring that not all women could marry. Widows were common and visible, and vulnerable to poverty and crime. For these reasons, women who were married to able-bodied men knew how fortunate they were relative to other women who had to resort to tedious jobs just to survive and treated their marriage with corresponding respect. 3. Prior to the invention of contraception, female promiscuity carried the huge risk of pregnancy and the resultant poverty and low social status. It was virtually impossible for any woman to have more than 2 to 3 sexual partners in her lifetime without being a prostitute, itself an occupation of the lowest social status. 4. Divorce carried both social stigma and financial losses for a woman. Her prospects for remarriage were slim. Religious institutions, extended clans, and broader societal forces were pressures to keep a woman committed to her marriage, and the notion of leaving simply out of boredom was out of the question. Today, however, all of these factors have been removed. This is partly the result of good forces, economic progress, and technology invented by beta men, but partly due to artificial schemes that are extremely damaging to society. For one thing, the wedding itself has gone from a solemn event attended only by close family and friends to an extravaganza of conspicuous consumption for the enjoyment of women, but financed by the hapless man. The wedding ring itself used to be a family heirloom passed down over generations, but now the bride thumbs through a catalog that shows her rings that the man is expected to spend 2 months of his salary to buy. The presumption that somehow the woman is to be indulged for entering the marriage is a complete reversal of centuries-old traditions grounded in biological realities, and evidence of how American men have become weak pushovers. In some Eastern cultures, for example, it is normal even today for either the bride's father to pay for the wedding or for the bride's family to give custody of all wedding jewelry to the groom's family. The reason for this was so that the groom's family effectively had a security bond against irresponsible behavior on the part of the bride, such as leaving the man at the Eastern equivalent of the altar, or fleeing the marital home at the first sign of distress, also a common female psychological response. For those wondering why Indian culture has such restrictions on women and not men, restrictions on men were tried in some communities, and those communities quickly vanished and were forgotten. There is no avoiding the reality that marriage has to be made attractive to men for the surrounding civilization to survive. Abuse and blackmail of women certainly occurred in some instances, but on balance, these customs existed through centuries of observing the realities of human behavior. Indian civilization has survived for over 5,000 years, and every challenge imaginable through enforcement of these customs, and, until recently, the Christian world also had comparable mechanisms to steer individual behavior away from destructive manifestations. However, if the wedding has mutated into a carnival of bridezilla narcissism, the mechanics of divorce are far more disastrous. In an at-will employment arrangement between a corporation and an employee, either party can terminate the contract at any time. However, instead of a few weeks of severance, imagine what would happen if the employer was legally required to pay the employee half of his or her paycheck for 20 additional years, irrespective of anything the employee did or did not do under penalty of imprisonment for the CEO. Suppose, additionally, that it is culturally encouraged for an employee to do this whenever even minor dissatisfaction arises. Would businesses be able to operate? Would anyone want to be a CEO? Would businesses even form, and thus would any wealth be created, given the risks associated with hiring an employee? Keep these questions in mind as we continue. So why are 70 to 90% of divorces initiated by women? She files 70% of the time, and the other 20% of the time, she forces the man to file due to abuse or adultery on the part of the woman. Women have always been hypergamous, and most were married to beta men that they felt no attraction towards. So what has changed to cause an increase in divorce rates? Divorce lawyers, like any other professional group, will seek conditions that are good for business. What makes attorneys different from, say, engineers or salespeople is that A, they know precisely how to lobby for changes to the legal system, bypassing voters in the US Constitution that guarantees more revenue for them, and B, what benefits them is directly harmful to the fabric of society in general, and to children in particular, when they collude with rage-filled feminists who openly say that 90% of the male gender should be exterminated, the outcome is catastrophic. The concept of no-fault divorce by itself may not be unfair. The concepts of asset division and alimony may also be fair in the event of serious wrongdoing by the husband. However, the combination of no-fault divorce plus asset division and alimony is incredibly unfair and prone to extortionary abuse. The notion that she can choose to leave the marriage, yet he is nonetheless required to pay her for years after that, even if he did not want to destroy the union, is an injustice that should not occur in any advanced democracy. Indeed, the man has to pay even if the woman has an extramarital affair, possibly even being ordered to pay her psychiatric fees. Bogus claims by feminists that women suffer under divorce are designed to obscure the fact that she is the one who filed for divorce. Defenders of alimony insist that a woman seeking a divorce should not see a drop in living standards, but it is somehow acceptable for the husband to see a drop even if he did not want a divorce. I would go further and declare that any belief that women deserve alimony on a no-fault basis in this day and age is utterly contradictory to the belief that women are equals of men. How can women both deserve alimony while also claiming equality? In rare cases, high-earning women have had to pay alimony to ex-husbands, but that is only 4% of the time versus the man paying 96% of the time. But it gets worse. Much worse, in fact. Even if the woman chooses to leave on account of boredom, she is still given default custody of the children, which exposes the total hypocrisy of feminist claims that men and women should be treated equally. Furthermore, the man is required to pay child support, which is assessed at levels much higher than the direct costs of childcare, with the woman facing no burden to prove the funds were spent on the child and cannot be specified by any prenuptial agreement. The rationale is that the child should not see a drop in living standards due to divorce. But since the mother has custody of child, this is a stealthy way in which feminists have ensured financial maintenance of the mother as well. So the man loses his children and most of his income, even if he did not want the divorce. But even that is not the worst-case scenario. The Bradley Amendment, devised by Senator Bill Bradley in 1986, ruthlessly pursues men for the already high child support percentages and seizes their passports and imprisons them without due process for falling behind in payments, even if on account of job loss during a recession. Under a bogus deadbeat dads media campaign, feminists were able to obscure the fact that women were the ones ending their marriages, and with them the benefits that children receive from a two-parent upbringing, and further demanding unusually high spousal maintenance, much of which does not even go to the child, from a dutiful ex-husband who did not want a divorce under penalty of imprisonment. So the legal process uses children as pawns through which to extract an expanded alimony stream for the mother. Talk about a multi-layer compounding of evil. The phony tactics of insisting that it is for the children is used to shut down all questions about the use of children as pawns in the extortion process, while avoiding scrutiny of the fact that the parent who is choosing divorce is clearly placing the long-term well-being of the children at a very low priority. So as it stands today, there are large numbers of middle-class men who are upstanding citizens, who were subjected to divorce against their will, had their children taken from them, pay alimony masked as child support that is so high that many of them have to live out of their cars or with their relatives, and after job loss from economic conditions, are imprisoned simply for running out of money. If 10 to 30% of American men are under conditions where 70% or more of their income is taken from them under threat of prison, these men have no incentive to start new businesses or invent new technologies or processes. Having 10 to 30% of men disincentivized this way cannot be good for the economy and is definitely a contributor to current economic malaise, not to mention a 21st-century version of slavery. Sometimes the children are not even biologically his. This one-page site has more links about the brutal tyranny that a man can be subjected to once he enters the legal contract of marriage, and even more so after he has children. What was once the bedrock of society and solemn tradition that benefited both men and women equally has quietly mutated under the evil tinkering of feminists, divorce lawyers, and leftists into a shockingly unequal arrangement where the man is officially a second-class citizen who is subjected to a myriad of sadistic risks. As a result, the word marriage should not even be used, given the totality of changes that have made the arrangement all but unrecognizable compared to its intended ideals. Suicide rates of men undergoing divorce run as high as 20%, and all of us know a man who has either committed suicide or admits seriously considering it during the dehumanization he faced, even though he wanted to preserve the union. Needless to say, this is a violation of the U.S. Constitution on many levels and is incompatible with the values of any supposedly advanced democracy that prides itself on freedom and liberty. There is effectively a tyrannical leftist shadow state operating within U.S. borders, but entirely outside of the U.S. Constitution, which can subject a man to horrors more worthy of North Korea than the U.S., even if he did not want out of the marriage, did not want to be separated from his children, and did not want to lose his job. Any unsuspecting man can be sucked into this shadow state. Anyone who believes that two-parent families are important to the continuance of an advanced civilization should focus on the explosive growth in revenue earned by divorce lawyers, court supervisors, and feminist organizations over the past quarter century. If Western society is to survive, these revenues should be chopped down to a tenth of what they presently are, which is what they would be if the elements that violate the U.S. Constitution were repealed. Marriage is no longer a gateway to female companionship, as we shall discuss later. For this reason, as a futurist, I cannot recommend marriage as the grotesque parody that it has become today to any young man living in the US, UK, Canada, or Australia. There are just too many things outside of his control that can catastrophically ruin his finances, emotions, and quality of life. At a minimum, he should make sure that having children is the most important goal of his life. If not, then he has insufficient reason to enter this contract. If this goal is affirmed, then he should conduct research by speaking to a few divorced men about the laws and mistreatment they were subjected to, and attend a few divorce court hearings at the local courthouse. After gaining this information, if he still wants to take the risk, he should only marry if he can meet the following three conditions, none of which can substitute either of the other two. Condition 1, the woman earns the same or more than he does. Condition 2, he has a properly done prenuptial agreement with lawyers on each side, even though a prenup will not affect the worst aspect of divorce law, child support as a cloak for stealth alimony and possible imprisonment. Part 3. He is deeply competent in the seduction arts and can manage his relationship with his wife effortlessly. Even this is a considerable workload, however. More on this later. There are still substantial risks, but at least they are somewhat reduced under these conditions. If marriage is a very important goal for a young man, he should seriously consider expatriation to a developing country where he ironically may have a higher standard of living in the U.S. after adjusting for divorce risk. So, to review, the differences between marriage 1.0 and marriage 2.0 are: A. No asset division and alimony, where the abandoned spouse has to pay if he earns more, even if he did not want a divorce, and even if he is a victim of abuse, cuckolding, or adultery. There are rare instances of high-earning women getting caught in this trap as well. B. Women marrying after having five or more sexual partners compared to just zero or one previously. This makes it harder for the woman to form a pair bond with her husband. C. Women marrying at an age when very few years of their peak beauty are remaining, compared to a decade or more remaining under marriage 1.0. And D. Child custody is almost never granted to the man, so if he loses his children on a no-fault basis. Traditional cultures marketed marriage with such punctilious alacrity that most people today dare not even question whether the traditional truths still apply. Hence, hostility often ensues from a mere attempt to even broach the topic of whether marriage is still the same concept as it once was. Everyone from women to sadistic social conservatives to a young man's own parents will pressure him and shame him into marriage for reasons they cannot even articulate and condemn his requests for a prenup without having any interest in even learning about the horrendously unequal and carefully concealed laws he would be subjected to in the event that his wife divorces him through no reasons he can discern. But some men with an eye on self-preservation are figuring this out, and so are avoiding marriage. By many accounts, 22% of men have decided to avoid marriage. So what happens to a society that makes it unattractive for even 20% of men to marry? Women are far more interested in marriage than men. Simple logic of supply and demand tells us that the institution of monogamous marriage requires at least 80% male participation in order to be viable. When male participation drops below 80%, all women are in serious trouble, since there are now 100 women competing for every 80 men, compounded with the reality that women age out of fertility much quicker than men. This creates great stress among the single female population. In the past, the steady hand of a young woman's mother and grandmother knew that her beauty was temporary, and that the most seductive man was not the best husband, and that they made sure the girl was married off to a boy with long-term durability. Now that this guidance has been removed from the lives of young women, thanks to feminism, these women are proving to be poor pilots of their mating lives, who pursue alpha males until the age of 34 to 36, when her desirability drops precipitously, and not even beta males she used to reject are interested in her. This stunning plunge in her prospects with men is known as the Wile E. Coyote moment, and women of yesteryear had many safety nets that protected them from this fate. The feminist media's attempt to normalize cougarhood is evidence of gasping desperation to package failure as a desirable outcome, which will never become mainstream due to sheer biological realities. Women often protest that a high number of sexual partners should not be counted as a negative on them, as the same is not negative for men, but this is merely a manifestation of solipsism. A complex sexual past works against women, even if the same works in favor of men, due to the natural sexual attraction triggers of each gender. A wise man once said, "A key that can open many locks is a valuable key, but a lock that can be opened by many keys is a useless lock." The big irony is that feminism, rather than improving the lives of women, has stripped away the safety nets of mother-grandmother guidance that would have shielded her from ever having to face her Wile E. Coyote moment. Feminism has put the average woman at risk in yet another area.